From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. On today's dialogue, we're continuing our theme of healthcare in the Black community. And this time, we're centering our conversation around Black maternal healthcare in America.
She wasn't taken seriously until a searing pain shot through her body and her baby's heart rate plummeted.
It's scary knowing that I could have died. You know, I couldn't, that my mom, my sister, my ex-husband would have to be, you know, taking care of my son and I wouldn't be.
And so they inverted my bed. I tried to remain pregnant for my baby to give him time to develop and proceeded to slowly die over the next 4 days.
Many pregnant people experience pressure from family or healthcare providers to get induced because, hey, they celebrate the holidays too. But there was no sign of an emergency with my baby, so I told them I wasn't ready yet. I told them my baby wasn't ready yet, and they told me that if I didn't come in to get induced, I would be going against hospital advice and expelled from the midwifery program altogether.
Those stories may sound familiar. The voices of Black women in Alabama, Boston, and Vermont. Instead of the experience of bringing a new life into the world peacefully, they were ignored, misinformed, and neglected. Black women are 4 times more likely to die from a pregnancy cause than white women, according to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. This is due to various factors like quality healthcare, underlying chronic issues, and structural racism. Today, we're starting the conversation with Dr. Imani Shepherd. She's an assistant professor at Carle College of Medicine and director of medical education and social scientific research at the Medical Humanities and Health Disparities Institute. She's also the founder of the Critical Engagement and Equity Doula Training Program, also known as the CEE program. And later, we'll be speaking with Shar Mitchell, a recent certified doula and mother from the CEE program. I first asked her to explain her role as the Director of Medical Education and Social Scientific Research at the Medical Humanities and Health Disparities Institute. She's also an assistant professor at Carle College of Medicine.
A lot of the work that I do looks at the intersection between health activism and academia. So I essentially like to tell people that I don't necessarily like to, I'm not like a liaison, right, to where I'm having conversations about conversations, but I really work heavily in looking at the relationship between medical inequities and health disparities, and how do we bridge that gap that exists between what is occurring, what is being discussed in academia and epistemologies and the practices of medicine, et cetera, and what is actually happening on the ground, right? So if we're talking about health inequities, how do we go about creating sustainable programming such that people have more equitable access to healthy food options or health care, all of these things? And what kinds of policies or procedures can we put into place that hopefully disseminate throughout the country to normalize and legitimize equitable access to health care and health care related services? So both things that I do, both at Carle Illinois College of Medicine and the Medical Humanities Health Disparities Institute, work to bridge that gap. So academia is at Carle, and the health activism essentially is at what's called MedWHO.
For those who aren't even aware of this maternal health crisis, can you tell us what America is facing right now?
It is something specifically that African-American women, women of the African diaspora, Native American and Alaskan Native women, and Hispanic women are facing, which is essentially we're dying at rates that mimic what we would often refer to as third world countries. Many Black women in particular know that if we're going to have babies, you need to probably have that baby at your house because you have a much higher survival rate than you do in the United States. The maternal mortality, infant mortality rate here in the United States for African-American women or women of the African diaspora is 3.9 times higher than it is anywhere else compared to individuals who are white or of European diaspora. And you see something equally high for Native Alaskan and Native American women. I think they're at like 2.5 times relative to the maternal mortality and infant mortality rate. And then we also see that women are dying, the time period that they're dying, 70-75% of that is occurring when they're supposed to be under the care of a physician. And so it's not that, you know, they're not having super healthy pregnancies or they're not taking care of themselves or they're not getting prenatal care, et cetera. It's once they're in the hospital or they're having a super high rate of C-sections when they may not necessarily need one. Their voices aren't being heard when they mention things like swollen feet and dizziness or pain. And so you're seeing high rates of preeclampsia. You're seeing, you know, embolisms, you're seeing all kinds of things, blood clots, things that are very, very avoidable that women are dying from. If an individual actually takes a moment to acknowledge and hear, hear a mom when she's saying something doesn't feel right. So we're dying at rates that are ridiculous, you know, to put it simply. There's so many people in so many programs that know these numbers, but we're not doing anything about it. We've known for, 10 years that these are the numbers and they're just getting worse.
Earlier, we've spoken about the criminalization of women's reproductive health.
Mm-hmm.
And I want to pick your brain on that. Can we say it's a war on women's reproductive health? What does this look like on a really big scale?
So one of the reasons why I wouldn't call it a war is because it has been long normalized and legitimized. If we look at the history of medicine, you'll see there's so much paternalism embedded in women's reproductive health associated with whether or not women can even consider their children, right? Right. If you look, we can look into the 16th, 17th century and we can see all of those things. And so because it has been normalized and legitimized through time and space, now when you're seeing things like the overturning of Roe v. Wade and the implementation of Dobbs, you know, we pick it for a month and then it's all become very normalized. But the criminalization part has come into play specifically relative to miscarriage.
Our next conversation with Dr. Imani Shepherd is on miscarriage. This dialogue uses language to describe a situation where a mother had a miscarriage, and this conversation may be triggering for some. We also play a news clip that describes the Cleveland mother's miscarriage experience with the hospital.
Outside of a courthouse in Warren, Ohio, a rally planned in support of Brittany Watts turned into a celebration after a grand jury announced Watts would not be charged with a felony. The 34-year-old medical receptionist was in her second trimester of what she thought was a healthy pregnancy. But on September 19th...
I went to my OBGYN once I started bleeding, and so I'm thinking something's not right.
Medical records show Watts was taken by ambulance to Mercy Health St. Joseph Warren Hospital, where doctors confirmed the fetus would not survive. A nurse called police at the direction of the hospital's risk management team. Watts was later arrested by the Warren Police Department and charged with abuse of a corpse.
Now that the charges have been dropped, I'm ready to get to work, making sure that the laws are changed and people are educated on what to do for something that happens all the time. And, you know, as the old saying goes, history repeats itself. I don't want it to happen in this case.
Dr. Shepherd, can you tell us a bit more about this case?
A young African-American female had a miscarriage. This is after being discharged from the hospital on three separate occasions where she said something wasn't right and she was bleeding. And she was still very early in her pregnancy, but it was large enough for it, you know, when she miscarried on the toilet, for it not to be able to go down the toilet. And so she ended up having to use a plunger to get the pieces of this the fetus out of the toilet. And she called the hospital and she's freaking out and she's trying to engage with what would have been her child. So there's already trauma there. But then when she spoke to the nurse sort of walked her through, you know, what she would need to do. And then the nurse called the cops on her and she was arrested for mishandling a corpse. And we see that as just being one example of how, you know, basic and very common thing that happens with a woman's body, the miscarriage is being perceived as her not contributing to society in a particular way, right? This is called biological citizenry. This is why the government gets to decide what we do with our uteruses, right? Or what our uteruses should be doing, or who gets to have babies, or who's being forcibly sterilized, all of those things. And so you're literally seeing criminalization associated with inequitable access to abortions, and you're seeing criminalization associated with women having miscarriages, and that being perceived as either murder or mishandling of a corpse, when again, it might be, you know, just a couple of weeks old, and it's a very normal thing, but it's still often traumatic for women. If you've ever spoken to a woman who's had a miscarriage, right? So you're going through that trauma in addition to being criminalized because of something that happened naturally to your body.
I want to take a minute to remind listeners you're currently listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Kennedy Vinson, and we're speaking about Black maternal health care in America with Dr. Imani Shepherd. She's an assistant professor at Carle College of Medicine, and she's the director of medical education and social scientific research at the Medical Humanities and Health Disparities Institute. The U.S. is facing extremely high maternal mortality and infant mortality rates for African American women. What are these numbers saying about the U.S., about our healthcare system, about the quality of our healthcare?
There's this idea that you can get a really good sense of where a community is or a civilization is based on how they care for people in their, when they're in their most vulnerable state. And we recognize that giving birth is this beautiful, wonderful thing, but it's extraordinarily hard on the body, right? And the fact that we as a country can continue to racialize, oppress, you know, and in some places exploit women's bodies or make sure that there is inequitable access to reproductive care speaks volumes about how we are perceived relative to our humanity. Actually, African American people were undertreated for pain across the board. And you see it with James Marion Sims's, you know, experiments on young girls. We often refer to them as women, but they were young girls, right? And everything we know about OB-GYN coming out of the experimentation of on these enslaved girls who were experimented on without anesthetics. And so there is a legacy of inequitable access to reproductive health care and inequitable access to pain management in particular. And again, it speaks volumes to the way that our humanity is acknowledged. And I think that we need to spend more time as a community of medicine, as well as in a global community, as well as, you know, the communities of marginalized and minoritized people, to be able to talk about the ways in which the histories and historiographies and epistemologies of medicine have framed inequities.
Just carrying some of the words that you used, Black women face even more risk, 3.9 times more likely to die from pregnancy-related causes than white women. This is a long history of systematic racism and many other factors. In this equation, how does a doula and a midwife step into this? And what is the role that they play? And then can you tell us the difference between a doula and a midwife?
That 0.9 is a whole bunch of people.
Yeah. Right?
So a midwife is an individual who is trained to provide medical services, right? They help to, what people often say, catch the baby. So they birth the baby and help mom, and they're able to move the baby around if the baby is breech, which is to say that their feet are coming out first. They do all of that. Doulas do not provide those kinds of medical services. The doulas actually provide non-medical resources, information, and care. And so sometimes what you'll see is a doula is there to provide additional support for mom. I think because there is a lack of acknowledgement of human engagement, that at what we found, we as in the global, you know, the medical community, what we found, what exists is that doulas actually help to reduce postpartum depression and postpartum anxiety, right? If you can be there to support someone and reassure them, if you can help to provide resources, doulas actually, in advocating for their patients, also help to reduce the number of C-sections. One of the things that happens is women should be comfortable with their decisions and with their birthing plan. And if you don't need a C-section, then you probably shouldn't be having one. And that doesn't mean that if the doctor's like, you need a C-section, you should be like, no, I want to keep pushing, and then you end up with a stillborn. No, that means if someone is going on vacation and wants to give you a C-section because it's convenient for their time frame, maybe you want to find someone else to help, you know, deliver your baby. So postpartum depression, postpartum anxiety, C-sections, breastfeeding, the potentiality of women breastfeeding also increases dramatically, which is really good for baby. But also the issues associated with shame and anxiety when women feel like they are not able to breastfeed. And so doulas have been also helping with that, because a lot of women feel like, well, everybody's telling me to breastfeed. I don't want to do that. Or it's really painful, or, you know, their work schedules don't allow for it. There's all kinds of things in the real world that people deal with that could hinder their ability or desire to breastfeed. And so a lot of the things that doulas help with increase the potentiality for quality of life and well-being before, during, and after a woman gives birth.
You're currently listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Right now, we're having a dialogue with Dr. Imani Shepherd on Black maternal health care in America. She's an assistant professor at Carle College of Medicine and the director of medical education and social scientific research at the Medical Humanities and Health Disparities Institute. Stay with us on Dialogue after this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. Right now, we're continuing our dialogue with Dr. Imani Shepherd. We're hearing about the disparities in the treatment Black women receive in the maternal healthcare system today. Dr. Imani Shepherd is an assistant professor at Carle College of Medicine, and she's the director of medical education and social scientific research at the Medical Humanities and Health Disparities Institute. She's also the founder of the Critical Engagement and Equity Doula Training Program, also known as the CEE program. And later, we'll be speaking with Shar Mitchell, a recent certified doula and mother from the CEE program. Dr. Shepherd, you've said that Black women are safer having their children at home. And I want to ask you if you could give us this history lesson. Can you break down the historical side of the Black maternal health care and what it's been like over time?
Yeah, so I will give you the information that I have on hand. Most of what I know has to do with where Black women are now. Again, because the work that I do looks at health disparities and inequities, you know, within this time frame and what we can do now. So I spend less time looking at, say, the history of doulas. But my understanding is that we used to have granny midwives, and granny midwives existed in enslaved communities. And then, you know, essentially throughout history within the African-American or African diaspora communities to help women give birth. And they were very well accepted. Of course, they're very knowledgeable. They've been doing this. They're, you know, this is trained from one generation to the next. And it wasn't until GYN became a specialization that you have more of an entrance into paternalism. And so men decided that, you know, they should be in charge of the way women were giving birth. And so then they stepped in, and then it became this very medicalized thing as opposed to something that women have been doing for centuries in their homes, in their communities, and ways to build their tribes. And I think that one way that people sort of were able to push up against the sort of hyper-medicalization of something that is very natural is through the development of doulas. And so it could just be that, you know, mom has a child and already has a child and she just gave birth to another child and it's difficult to manage, or she, whatever it is, and a doula can help to, you know, engage with the younger child while mom is practicing self-care and things like that. So those histories come out of, you know, the need for other kinds of support mechanisms, other members of your tribe that are no longer a normal part of how we engage in society.
You started the CEE program, which stands for Critical Engagement and Equity Doula Training Program. Mm-hmm. Tell us more about this. I know it's less than a year old, and why was it important for you to build this in Champaign-Urbana?
Yeah, so Critical Engagement of Equity, or CEDoula program, essentially came out of conversations with Antoinette Burton at the Humanities Research Institute. They've been extraordinarily supportive, her and Nancy Cruzan, with providing support for ways to, again, bridge that gap between the kinds of things that are discussed in academia, the prevalence and risk of this and that and sickness and yada, 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 with actually developing sustainable programs to make positive impacts on the community. And because so much of the work that I do at the Medical Humanities and Health Disparities Institute looks at how we can positively engage with society and help to empower people to advocate for themselves, have the language to advocate for themselves, which is really important because, you know, in medicine, as with any other field, it has its own language, its own lexicon. And so then you're sitting in this room with a physician and they're saying all of these things and you don't know what the hell they're talking about, right? So having the language to be able to advocate for themselves and be able to have a high level of health literacy and other forms of information to increase the, you know, the possibility of positive health outcomes. So in having these conversations, I was like, you know what I've always wanted to do? You know, and I told the participants as well, it is so important for you to be in this space and decide you're going to do the work. So if you're not interested in doing the work, this isn't the right program for you, right? Just to put it very bluntly. So the critical engagement is, you know, the foundation and the driving force of why, you know, I decided to even develop a doula program. So now you know why we need it. And let's get out into the communities and teach people and help people to, you know, ideally help to reduce maternal mortality and infant mortality. And so it's a really beautiful thing. We have one student who is African-American and Native American who wants to be able to take this information and these trainings to be able to help women on the reservation that she's associated with. And another individual who does work with Alaskan Native women. And then we have, you know, an additional four students who'll be working with African-American communities in New Orleans and in Chicago, and one individual in Kankakee. And so that is the ideal situation, is to be able to democratize the work that we're doing, democratize these knowledges, and be able to help advocate and empower people to, again, ideally move towards healthier outcomes.
On the topic of healthier outcomes, how do we broaden this scope of health equity? What does the future look like? How do we facilitate mm-hmm. equity?
So the New Orleans in me is going to start that response out with, "Hoo, child." Hoo, child. So I think, again, we've known the numbers for a while, right? We continue to know the numbers. We also continue to see, you know, Black women die. When we don't need to. We never need to die unless it's old age, right, across the board. And so it has to move beyond the conversations. It has to move beyond the risk. It has to move beyond looking at these numbers and, again, having this discussion of what are we going to do? But before laying the tracks, you don't just want to lay the tracks while the train is moving, right? We need to embed within medical education and other forms of healthcare-related services, discussions of why we're dying, right? Because we're largely dying because of varying forms of inequities and healthcare biases that are built into the framework that have been normalized and legitimized. And a lot of times people don't even realize that they're participating in these systems because they are just common practice. And so we need to have those conversations, and we need to center what the standard of care should be for everyone so that we're actually, you know, having conversations about treating the clinical presentation of a thing or of an issue, treating the clinical presentation, what you're seeing, as opposed to you seeing your own biases or you seeing your own, you know, your historiographies that are facilitating stereotypes of shame, et cetera, et cetera. So we have to move beyond the conversation and get to causality and get to the why. And then we need to build programming, sustainable programming that has a level of, intentionality and scaffolding so that we're not just building to build. And then we also need to be in communities to be able to talk to people about how to help facilitate healthy outcomes and try to get grocery stores in every neighborhood, right? Like, that's ridiculous that we still have food deserts. It's ridiculous that some places only have food swamps, which just means that they only have, you know, fast food restaurants in those areas. It's ridiculous that they have so many neighborhoods where there's one hospital that's an hour away, hour and a half away, and that hospital doesn't have OB-GYN services, right? And you're seeing those, more and more of those getting pulled from hospitals or being put in other places, right? In addition to, like, mental health services, in addition to all of the things that people need holistically to be well. And so I think that, you know, again, starting with the ways in which structural violences have informed practices of medicine, epistemologies, which are the knowledges that create knowledge. So the epistemologies of medicine, how those things have been normalized and legitimized, we have to start there and then also confront what communities need so that people have holistic access to all kinds of things to help potentiate positive health outcomes. So it's a lot, but it's not to say that it can't be done, because we have the resources, we have the voices, we have the bodies to do it, but there has to be a desire to do it.
You've done such powerful work in the community, and I feel like we need to recognize that you were the first African-American in the United States to graduate with a PhD in the field of medical humanities.
Yeah.
Well, let's give you your flowers, first of all.
Well, thank you, darling. Thank you. I do what I can. No. Yeah. So I graduated from the University of Texas Medical Branch, and they're the only school, at least at the time, the only school to offer a PhD program in the medical humanities at the time. And I was their first African-American graduate and their first African-American student. Like, so it wasn't even like a student came and didn't make it through. It's like, for a long time, I guess they just were like, this is not a good fit. And also medical humanities, now people refer to it as health humanities, so it's a little bit more expansive, but was always a niche field. And as we know, you know, African-American people don't have equitable access to certain kinds of jobs or economic opportunities. There's a lot of economic oppression that happens. And so I think it being a niche field associated with medicine, you know, was jarring for people when I show up. And then they're like, I'm sorry, where are you going? But I've also, at that point, I was also very used to being the only African-American. I've been the only African-American in many places. So I got my master's in medical anthropology. I was the only African-American in that program. Right? I was in biological anthropology for my bachelor's. I was the only African-American in that program. The first full-time teaching position I had, I was the only African-American full-time professor there. Like, you know, so it is largely due, I think, to people feeling like there are black jobs that that are crafted for us and things that are not crafted for us. And my mother made very clear that when she was alive, that is a farce. That while you may need to speak 7 languages and be 5 times better to get into the room, you're in the room. And so whatever job or whatever space you want to be in, you deserve to be in. And I think that that's a struggle for many people, realizing that you don't have to filter into a certain framework or a certain job or a certain thing. But it also means that you'll often be the only. And what does that mean for you and what your role becomes, right?
Vice President Kamala Harris came into office saying she would be a key leader on maternal health and its outcomes. Have we seen any progress?
I think the American progress narrative is problematic in and of itself, is how I'll answer that. Because the American progress narrative, you know, simply put, has all of this language about anyone can come and pull themselves up by the bootstraps, and never acknowledges that we have millions of people with no boots. Millions of people with no shoes. So what bootstraps are you supposed to be using to pull yourself up? And it's not even that I can't even go buy the boots.
Can't
right?
even go to the store.
I can't even go to the store. This store doesn't even exist. The boot selling store doesn't even exist in my neighborhood. So what are you talking about, pulling myself up by my bootstraps? And I have inequitable access to boots.
Dr. Imani Shepherd, thank you so much for this intentional dialogue with us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
If you're interested in learning more about the C Doula training program, you can visit will.illinois.edu/dialogue. You're currently listening to Dialogue on Illinois Soul. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Coming up next, we're speaking with Char Mitchell. She's a mother and a recent certified doula from the C Doula program. She'll be sharing her perspectives on what she learned from the doula training program, how she continues to move forward by facilitating equity through her work, and her reflections on how to create a birthing plan and helping future generations ahead. Stay with us on Dialogue after this short break. From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. On today's dialogue, we're continuing our theme of healthcare in the Black community, specifically the Black maternal healthcare crisis in America. We spoke with Dr. Imani Shepherd. She's an assistant professor at Carle College of Medicine, and she's the director of medical education and social scientific research at the Medical Humanities and Health Disparities Institute. She spoke with us about the disparities that Black women face today. She created the Critical Engagement of Equity Doula Training Program, also known as the CEE Doula Program. The program is designed to address some of the structural violences and healthcare biases that African American women, Native Indian, and Alaskan Native women and babies are currently facing. Next, we're speaking with Char Mitchell. She just received her doula certification from the C Doula Training Program with Dr. Shepherd. You recently graduated from the CEE Doula Program. Congratulations.
Thank you.
And thank you so much for joining us on Dialogue today as well.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
So how was the CEE program? Can you tell us a bit about that?
It was an emotional roller coaster, but it was wonderful. It was wonderful. It was so enlightening. It just kind of opened my eyes to what's going on in our world here with women's health care. And I think I just really didn't pay attention. This class highlighted all of that for me. And as I mentioned before, when we talked, it just kind of broke my heart to hear how people of color are being treated in the healthcare industry, the disparities that have taken place, that are still taking place, and just the inequality of healthcare that's out there.
Before you entered the CEE program, did you have any knowledge or awareness of the inequalities and disparities that were happening with mothers when entering the hospital for birth?
I didn't as much as I learned about. I'd only heard a few stories, but I didn't think it was a big deal, a big issue. I just thought, you know what, things happen. After the class and while we were in class and learning and reading and watching videos and just seeing what's really happening, again, it just broke my heart. And I felt, I just felt like I had my head in the sand or something, or I just wasn't paying attention or looking hard enough. But I thank God that, you know, I was able to come through. It wasn't my story. I felt really bad because I didn't know what was going on. And I felt like, you know what, am I part of the problem too? You know, because I don't know. And I didn't know what to tell even my own daughter, who has had some issues, but because we are taught to trust the healthcare providers, we're taught to trust what people in authority, those who have a degree or they are doctors or they are nurses or they have something that I don't, they know more. But that's not always the truth. That's not always the case. They know about the medicine, but they don't know the people, the person. What I've learned and come away with after going through the CEE course is that we know our body. We know our bodies. We know what's going on better than anybody else. We go to the experts for a more in-depth, you know, look at what's going on, but we can tell you what's happening in our bodies. And the thing that really hit me was that they're just not listening and they don't care enough to hear what we're saying. That part broke my heart and it angered me. As I mentioned, my daughter, she had children and I felt so bad because I felt like, you know what? I wasn't a good advocate for her because I took what they said, what the doctor said. And I agreed, okay, that's fine. If that's what you say, then no, that's fine. But it wasn't fine. And so she suffers today because of what she endured. And I didn't realize how bad it was until taking this course. Wow, we have to speak up. We have a voice. We have to be our own advocates.
How do you feel as a mother after you went through the C program? What did that do for you?
It made me rethink my childbirth experiences and how they could have been better, or how I could have taken more of a role, played more, you know, of a, I would have had a voice in how I delivered, how I carried. Basically, again, didn't know that I could speak out on my own behalf in those instances, that I could exercise my voice, that I could say, hey, you know what? I'd rather do this. I would rather have a home birth, or I would rather not lay down flat and, you know, and deliver my child. Just any number of things. I didn't realize that I could have had asked for a midwife, or that I could have even had a doula. Tell you the truth, I don't even think I knew what a doula was at that point when I was giving birth. It's about education, getting the word out that, you know what, you don't have to just take whatever they're giving. You don't have to just accept what's being told. You can do your own research. You can look into what you want, what's best for you and your lifestyle, your body, your family, and make those decisions.
What are your hopes for future women, future Black women, understanding that they have options to create a birthing plan and that they have a voice? And what's your hope for them as a now doula?
I'm seeking out my first client, which is not really going to be a client. It'll be I just found out that my grandson, he is expected. I want to just talk to them about, you know, having a birthing plan, have a plan. And I don't think that they know that this is something that you can do. You can You know, you have a birthing plan. You can decide how you want to bring this child into the world. I just want to make sure that women know they have options. They have, you know, there are choices. You decide, and that you can speak up. And if you are with a provider who won't listen, get a different one. You don't have to stay, or get a midwife. I want women to know that these are options for you.
Char Mitchell, thank you so much for having this dialogue with me.
Yeah, it was a pleasure. I enjoyed it.
Thank you. That was Char Mitchell from the C Doula Training Program. It's a program with community partnerships with BIPOC for Better Health, the Medical Humanities and Health Disparities Institute, and funding from the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign's Humanities Research Institute. The dialogue team asked Dr. Imani Shepherd to close our episode with a poem. The poem is The Afterbirth, 1931 by Nikki Finney. Nikki Finney is an American poet. She's an advocate for social justice and cultural preservation. Her poem titled The Afterbirth, 1931, tells the story of the birth of her father. The poem reveals the tragedies of race in America and the complex realities a Black woman faced in the 1930s. The poem highlights a story of recently enslaved elders and a family who watched as a mother is in labor, ready to give birth to her child.
The Afterbirth by Nikki Finney, as well as Afterbirth 1931 by Nikki Finney. We were a colored clan of kinfolk who threw soil, not salt, over our shoulders, who tendered close the Bible, who grew and passed around the almanac at night so we would know what to plant at first light. Black soil and sweet brown sorghum from every morning biscuits Mama Susan fixed, dripping and mixing up under our fingernails a secret salve. Just like any other, living simple and keeping our proud selves, quite aware of night riders, quite aware of men with politicious smiles, cologne with kerosene and match, aware of just whose feet walked across our tin roofs at night. We were such light sleepers, such long distance believers. We were a family pregnant whose water had broke, and for once there was ham money. Baca money. So we thought to do better by ourselves. To begin our next row, we would go and get him because he was medically degreed and baby bringing, because he was young and white and handsome, and because of that had been neighbor to more knowledge than us way back behind the country's proud but inferior lines. And because he came with his papers in his pocket so convincing, so soon after his Ivy graduation, asking us hadn't we heard, telling us times had changed and the midwife wasn't safe anymore. Even though we had all been caught by tried and true Black grannies who lay axe blade sharp upside and water pan underneath the bed to cut the pain, to cool the fever. We were a pregnant clan of kinfolk, caught with water running down our legs. Old families say they remember going to fetch him, telling him that it was time, that he should come now, but he didn't show right away. Not right away. He came when he wanted, the next day, after his breakfast. But what more could we colored country folk ever want, even if we had to watch the road all night for him, even if we had to not let her push too hard when he finally came? He had his papers on him, something with one of those pretty shiny seals, old families say. They can remember something just wasn't right. But we opened the screen for him anyway, trusting and tending close what the good book had told us all our lives to do. Then we made him a path where he put his hand up then inside my grandmother's womb, her precious private pleasing place, somewhere he probably didn't want to touch. Then he pulled my daddy through, somebody he probably didn't care to reach for. And from the first he pulled him wrong, and wrong shattered his collarbone and snapped his soft baby foot in half and smashed the cartilage in his infant hand. Ringing their own sun-baked arms, old-timely family remember him well. They say they knew something wasn't right as he came through the door a day later. His breakfast digested now, something just wasn't right. How he had two waters on him, one sweet and one sour smash. one trying to throw snow quilt over the other as he uncarefully, as drunkenly, he with his papers him on him still, stood there turning a brown baby into blue, unmagically, and right before our eyes, hope and pray, then he packed his bag and left with all of his official training and gathered up gold stars, left. The Virginia land of Cumberland County, he left and forgot, he left and forgot, he left and didn't remember the afterbirth inside Carlene Goodwin Finney. To clabber, gangrene, close down her place, her precious private pleasing place, to fill the house to the rafters up past the dimpled tin roof with a rotting smell that stayed for 9 days, that mortgaged a room in our memories and did not die with her. We were a brown and pregnant family. As he would have remembered his schooling and left his bottle, recollected his manners, and brought his right mind, had another clan called him to their bedside, he would have come right away. He would have never had liquor on his breath. If the color of my daddy's broken limbs had matched the color of his own, but we were a colored clan of kinfolk, we should have met him at the door. Should have told him, lean first into the rusty screen, made him open up his mouth and blow, breathe out right there into all of our brown and lined up faces in weight of his worthiness. Then, just for good measure, should have made him blow once again into Papa John's truth-telling jar. Just to be sure, should have let Mama Sally, then Aunt Nanny, then lastly Aunt Mary, give him the final once over and hold his sterile hands down to the firelight to check, just like they checked our own every night. Before supper, before we were allowed to sit at her very particular table, we could have let Aunt Ira clutch him by the chin, enter and leave through her eyes, just like how she came and went through us every day at her leisure. She would have took care to notice as he traveled up and through him any shaking, any sweating, and caught his incapable, belligerent incompetence in time, oh Jesus. We should have let Grandpop Robert have him from the first, should have let him pick him up by the back of his pants and swirl him around just like he picked us up and swirled us around any time he caught us lying or lazy or being less than we were. We should have let Grandpop loose on him from the start, and he would have held him up high, eye to the sun, and looked straight through him just like he held us up, and then we would have known first, like he always knew first, and brought to us the very map of his heart. Then we would have known just what his intentions were with our Carlene. Before we knew his name or cared about his many degrees, before he dared reach up, then inside our family's brown globe, while we stood there, some of us throwing good black soil with one hand, some of us tending close the good book with the other, believing and trusting we were doing better by this one, standing there, waterfalls running, screaming whitewater rapids, down our pants legs, down our pantaloons to our many selves, all the while praying hard that maybe we were wrong. Please, please make us wrong. Please make us wrong that 100 proof smelled the same as isopropyl.
The Dialogue team would like to thank Dr. Imani Shepherd and Char Mitchell for speaking with us about Black maternal health care in America. You can find Dialogue wherever you listen to your podcasts. And you can give us a follow on Instagram and Facebook at Illinois Soul. The Dialogue show is produced by Nidhi Shastri, Penny Bradford, and myself, Kennedy Vincent. Our news and public affairs director is Reginald Hardwick, and production assistance by Steve Mork. Dialogue's theme song is by Lamont Holden. Dialogue is a part of Illinois Soul and Illinois Public Media. Join us for our next dialogue every Saturday morning at 11 a.m. and Tuesday night at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul FM 101.1 and WILL AM 580 Wednesdays at 8 p.m.